This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. It's the third Thursday of the month, the day we talk about computers on the Afternoon Magazine. On the program today, how the web is changing business. A cartoon this week in the newspaper depicts father and son. Each is looking at a screen. Dad says, "Tell me something, son. Do you understand any of these TV ads for these dot-com companies?" Junior, who's online, replies, "What's TV?" Two guests are with us this afternoon to take your questions. Joining us by phone, David Weinberger. He's the editor of JOHO, that's J-O-H-O, Journal of the Hyperlinked Organization. David Weinberger is also a commentator for National Public Radio and one of the authors of the new book, The Clue Train Manifesto, The End of Business as Usual. The book gets its name from a veteran executive from a former Fortune 500 company. The executive described his company's demise like this: "The Clue Train stopped here four times a day for 10 years, and they never took delivery." Also worth noting here, the book is a sequel to a website, www.cluetrain.com. Here with me in the studio this afternoon, University of Illinois technology trainer Peter Kimball. Peter Kimball is the education program coordinator and lead faculty trainer for the university's faculty and staff technology training. Listeners, you can join us here in our radio chat room with your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 1-800-222-WILL. David Weinberger, Peter Kimball, thanks for joining us this afternoon. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you.
And thank you very much. Good to be here.
David Weinberger, first question for you. How clueless are businesses at this point?
Almost totally. Most businesses are still in the state of denial when it comes to the web. The web represents a huge threat to the normal way of doing business, as well as a gigantic opportunity, of course. And most businesses have responded, at least initially, at least so far, by doing more of the same, by putting up meaningless, space-wasting websites, and thinking that they are now continuing to control their environment, which they don't.
Hmm.
Well, how much do you think, David, is the corporate inertia, the momentum that they've got, the lack of momentum? Because I think you mentioned several places in the book, along with some of the other authors, that it's hard to find somebody who doesn't, in person, agree that things are changing.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. Much of it is corporate inertia, and behind the inertia is corporate fear, which has been the guiding principle of business for the past 100 years. Fear that if their customers actually saw what was going on inside the business, some great secret would be given away. And the secret is, of course, simply that businesses are made up of fallible human beings, and they're not these efficient machines that always make right decisions. And for some reason, businesses are desperately afraid of customers finding that out, even though customers already know it. And, of course, everybody inside the organization already knows it. It's the biggest open secret in our century.
So it's folks behind closed doors.
Yes, and in most cases, of course not all, but in most cases, businesses are using their websites as a further way of closing the door, of putting up a wall to keep customers away from the simple truth about the business.
Yeah.
And it's a great shame. It's a terrible shame, because businesses and customers generally have something really interesting that they want to talk about, which is what the customers are buying, about the products or the area in which the product exists. And people who buy cars are very interested in cars frequently, and people who buy drills are interested in drills, and people who buy decorative plates and so forth. So there's a real, on the inside of the organization, there's typically people who are quite passionate about what they're doing. The customers are quite passionate about it, and the business has gotten it into its head that its job is to keep those two people apart. Well, the web puts them together.
Yeah. Generally, people want to like one another.
They want to like one another. They understand that the people that, you know, if you have a chance to actually talk with somebody inside the organization, and Ford, for example, has just announced that they're giving 350,000 employees, every employee gets a free computer and web access. And what will happen, I believe, is that when you have a chance now to talk with the people inside of Ford who are doing the real work of Ford, you'll find out that, first of all, they're real ordinary people like the rest of us, that they're capable of talking in their own voice, and they'll say really interesting things. What's not an interesting thing is to repeat the Ford tagline over and over, which is what business generally thinks it's in the business of doing. Hmm. So who wants to hear that? We want to talk with people. That's why we're on the web.
Yeah, you write in the book, or maybe it's one of your co-authors, conversations online are spawning a new kind of intellectual bravery, more comfortable with risk than with regulation. But the old way is very much about avoiding or limiting risk and maintaining control.
That's right. And the web is the world's largest unmanaged environment. It would not have been built had it been managed. It would never have gotten built if it had been centrally planned and controlled. If a business had tried to build the web, it wouldn't have gotten anywhere. The essence of the web is that it's an open, unmanaged space. It is not controllable. And that's why it's a tremendous threat to companies that choose to see it as such.
Well, kind of following along in the same thesis that you're promoting in the book, which, of course, all seem quite reasonable, I was looking just a little bit earlier this morning at the Amazon.com site, and 37 people have taken the time and trouble to write, for the most part, outstanding reviews of the Clue Train Manifesto. I think one or two people might have said it's like preaching to the choir, but that's probably because some folks wonder, why doesn't everybody already get this? If all of the people who are reading and taking the time to respond in the reviews online find this so clear and so true, how do you suppose we can, or how do you suppose the web will eventually make that communication available from within companies? Is it going to take the demise of companies or the drastic reduction in market share? Or are some of these reviewers likely to be CEOs and chairmen of the board?
The favorite response of mine and of my co-authors to the book has been, and to the website as well, where thousands of people have read it and signed up. And the absolute favorite response is something along the lines of, it's about time, or you said exactly what we were thinking. Because what the book and the website say are, in one sense, completely unremarkable. It's what almost everybody who's spent some serious time on the web already knows, that we're there because we like the conversation. It's not because we want to see more banner ads. It's not even because it's so much easier to order from an online catalog as opposed to a printed catalog. I mean, that's great, but that's not why our culture is so excited about the web. Now we have electronic catalogs, which is all that e-commerce has been so far. It's because we're totally excited about the fact that here's a place where we can talk in our own voice about the things that matter to us, to everybody around the world, with everybody around the world. And really, I think a stunning example of this is the Amazon one, where if you look up Harry Potter books, you'll find literally thousands of reviews, many, many, many of them from children. My 9-year-old, who's moderately comfortable on the web, nevertheless has the sense that he's capable of writing something that the world can read. We've never had that before. It's never been possible. That's tremendously exciting. Yeah. It's got nothing to do with e-commerce.
It's the same thing with the phenomenon of the homepage. Everybody's got a homepage.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a place in which you can stand forth and say what you want. You don't have to sound like you do at work. We're all used to sounding different than we do at home, at work. Web page, a homepage, which was the thing that first sort of kicked off the web, was the reason why it was exciting. I think you're exactly right. It's here's the place where I can say to the world, here I am. Never before possible.
Well, as technology continues to improve and people get faster connections through the various means, cable modems and such, and as more and more hypermedia starts to become part of the web, are we in danger, do you think? I'd seen some commentary at some point about whether this will almost become more passive. You sit back and click on this link and you listen to a commentary, or you sit back and watch a video of some sort. Is that likely to be a danger in this communication, the two-way communication?
I actually don't think so. The web is not a finite space the way the real world is. So in the real world, if you get some mega mall put in, if AOL Time Warner were to build a huge mall in the center of your town, it would be unavoidable, and it would drive out other business. On the web, they can build the biggest mall or broadcast station that they want on the web. They may get lots of people going there. That's fine. I may go there. There may be some interesting stuff. But that still won't affect my ability to route around them, to find other people who want to talk about what I want to talk about and not just sit passively and listen to more advertising coming from a broadcaster. We can get that on the TV. Yeah. So we can route. The great thing about the web is it routes around obstacles. It was built technically in its architecture in order to do that. And it also does it socially and culturally. It does it inside of the business. It does it among people who are among the market.
The cartoon I mentioned in the introduction, I think, speaks to this very point. I think Junior has no interest in the television because it's too cool. It's too passive, a medium. And the web, like radio, is a hot medium.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a medium in which we connect with other people. We do it through email and discussion rooms and chat, and sometimes by reading home pages. But it's a point-to-point, person-to-person medium. And the email that comes across your desk every day can come from people that you never met from around the world, and you engage in maybe a brief conversation with them that 5 years ago would have been unthinkable. And now it happens every day. And it's thrilling.
In the university environment, of course, we're a little bit blessed compared to the traditional corporate environment. But in the corporate environment, is there likely to be, before the web becomes more pervasive, before the conversations start taking place, both within and without, some backlash? I mean, we see the news about companies instituting email monitoring policies and such. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to see backlash, and in some sense, I mean, backlash sounds like it's an attempt to squash, and we'll certainly see that, but we'll also see something that will look like backlash, which is companies genuinely trying to figure out the intersection of these two worlds, which have different sort of physical laws, the real world and the web world, but also different expectations. And it's a very difficult problem, because right now we don't know what one of the worlds is like. We have a fully formed set of laws for one world, for governing, for example, intellectual property, that absolutely doesn't apply to a web world.
And what about the issue of privacy? Do you think our ideas about privacy will be reshaped?
I think that, yes. I think they're inevitably going to be so, but I think something even more important will happen. Because privacy is a term that's in a constellation of other terms, public, private, and your sense of self. It's actually a rich sort of semantic stew of concepts that even the notion of privacy requires. And all of those are being redone as well. The concept, the nature of the self on the web is different for some obvious reasons. For one, nobody knows who you are, which is the oldest New Yorker cartoon,
right,
and a very, very deep and true one. You know, on the web, nobody knows you're a dog.
Yeah, two dogs sitting together. One's on the computer.
Exactly. So on the web, nobody knows that you're male, female, white, black, tall, fat, whatever. They also don't know that you're the same person you were 5 minutes ago. Mm-hmm. Right? You can adopt a new name, and that leads to abuses. It leads to a huge amount of play also. And I think that it may also lead to some changes in our very notion of what it means to be a public self.
Mm. This is The Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. We're talking this afternoon about the web and how it is changing business and other institutions. Our guests this afternoon, joining us on the telephone, David Weinberger. He is one of the authors of the Clue Train Manifesto, The End of Business as Usual. Here with me in the studio, University of Illinois technology trainer Peter Kimball. Listeners, you can join the conversation this afternoon. Your questions and comments are welcome in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 1-800-222-WILL. David, the Clue Train Manifesto opens with 95 theses. The first one, markets are conversations. Number two, markets consist of human beings, not demographic sectors. Maybe you would talk with us about these leadoff points and maybe share a couple of other points that you raise in the Clue Train Manifesto so our listeners will have a better handle on the manifesto.
Okay, good. The manifesto, in a sense, says something pretty straightforward, which is that there are two conversations going on. One is among the people in the market. Markets used to be literally conversations before the Industrial Revolution. They were places that you went to. And after the Industrial Revolution, markets or marketing became something that you did to people, where the idea was in a broadcast environment, mass marketing arising from mass manufacturing, that people were relatively passive. They're sitting in front of their TV. They can't wait to get the messages that are being delivered from the business, from the corporation. When in fact, of course, we all hate getting messages from markets, from businesses. We avoid them whenever possible. So marketing was a type of war practiced on an unwilling population trying to get them to buy your stuff. Well, the web comes along and it returns markets, it turns them back into conversations. For us, for the authors of the book, the web is primarily, the right metaphor to use is, it's a conversation. It's not even a medium and it's not a shopping mall. It's a set of global conversations. And that transforms markets because now we have a better source of information than we ever had before. The vendors were always the worst source of information because they're trying to sell us stuff. But if we can talk with one another, which we can on the web incredibly easily, we tell each other the truth. And so we can route around the marketing messages. Exactly the same type of conversation occurs inside of organizations. So one of the other theses is that hyperlinks subvert hierarchies. That is, org charts in this case. Businesses have practiced a form of command and control, establishing hierarchical org charts in order to, basically delude themselves into believing they can manage an unmanageable environment, a set of people. Well, the web enables the people in the organization to route around the org chart to find other people with similar interests, customer-focused interests frequently, often, and to get work done faster and more creatively, and also to avoid the internal marketing of the company that keeps telling them that everything is perfect, that all the customers are happy, the CEO is brilliant, and which everybody knows isn't true anyway. The book then says that these two conversations inevitably are going to join, the market conversation and the internal conversation inside of organizations.
What about the accessibility issue? If one were a cynic, one could say, well, all right, we have perhaps 50%, I don't know what the precise numbers are, of American households with access to the web who regularly use the web or other aspects of the Internet from day to day. And there's generally the lower socioeconomic class who may not be able to afford those connections, but now we may possibly, and so they're left out of this conversation. But now some corporations are coming along and helping make that technology available, and the only catch is that you'll use this Internet service provider and you'll be getting these ads regularly because you don't really have the means to afford your independent access, so we're going to give you our canned presentation. It's almost like broadcasting restructured.
That's right. It's putting permanent ads floating across the bottom of your screen, and for some people that's going to be the price of admission. I don't know how. I have no idea whether that's going to work out in the long run. Whether the providers of that type of quote free, of course, it's not free. Because you're paying for the through the ads, but whether
more,
that
maybe.
Type of free offer is going to make economic sense for the businesses doing it. But access to the web will become, I think, inevitably as widespread as access to the telephone system. It's obviously not there yet, and on a country-by-country basis, there are huge, huge disparities, and that's a very serious issue.
Yeah. Talk with us some more about that issue, because I think that's really interesting and very important. Okay, we're on the web, and we're loving it, and we want to talk to the whole world, right?
Yep.
So how can we help make that happen?
Well, it's very hard for any of us to make that happen because of the nature because of the size of the world and the nature of the economic system.
Mm-hmm.
But the only good news that I can find in the split of the haves and the have-nots, the ons and the not-ons, is that that the barrier to getting on is relatively low compared to some other barriers, and that once that happens, the web is intensely leveling. So while there is a huge and distressing, dismaying disparity in people's access to the web, once that's provided, it's much easier to catch up than with other types of economic changes.
A moment ago, Peter asked you about advertising on the web, and I was wondering, does advertising on the web work? Do those banner ads work?
No, primarily not. I mean, you can always find instances where they do, but a huge percentage of the banner ads that you see on the web are sort of phony money in the first place. They're swaps. Two companies swap banner ads, and they count it as income. It's but there's no real value being exchanged. There's software available that blocks ads pretty effectively, and of course, it's free.
Hmm. You mentioned a while ago your 9-year-old on the web, telling people what he thought of Harry Potter. There are so many voices out there on the web, and if business people, they want to get their voice heard, how does a business or any other institution for that matter make its voice come through?
Well, I will give you an answer, but I'm not sure it's going to make anybody happy. And I think the answer is, have something interesting to say. That's how you get your voice heard. And by the way, talk like a human being. this corporate language and insistence on messaging and all, is everybody can spot it in an instant, and we turn it off. Nobody wants to talk to somebody who's that boring. Somebody sat down next to you at a party and sounded the way corporate messaging sounded, marketing sounded, you'd get up and leave. I mean, this is the most boring, self-serving, insipid stuff written in the stilted language ever created. And the only reason you ever sat still for it was that it was the only thing coming across on the TV. Well, too bad. We have many, many more interesting people to talk with than most corporations at this point. So, you know, have something to say. Talk about something that we're interested in, not what you're interested in. Talk about something that your customers are actually interested in, and do it in a human voice with real human beings. Don't make everything go through the marketing department and the PR department. Open up the floodgates.
And that's oftentimes so much easier said than done. A very telling example in your book is, I don't remember if it was your section, a person who got it. They knew what this communication was all about, and they were fascinating. And then they got up to give a PowerPoint presentation or some kind of sales presentation for the company, and they reverted to corporate speak and mouthing the platitudes and presenting the company line. And then came back and said, well, how was that? And how do you really say, you know, that was really about the awfulest thing I heard. So how do you get it? How do you break this? I wonder how you break people into this sudden change of awareness.
It's a great question. I don't think that there's a simple answer to it, because you're talking about how people change, and there's lots and lots of ways people do it. Sometimes by example, sometimes by being nudged, but in so many cases, and I've seen this at the very top of organizations, and I've seen it all the way across the broadest reach of the organization, that people do get it. They realize that now, I mean, put it like this, they realize that they don't need permission from someone to be on the web and to sound like themselves. Suddenly it just hits them. Maybe they get an email from somebody and they say, oh, it just strikes them. I could write like this. I could write like myself. And the moment that they do this, they laugh, they giggle. There's a particular sound, a particular laugh that occurs when somebody realizes that he or she does not have to give him or herself permission. That nobody has to give you permission. Hmm. And that's the liberating moment.
It's if you look at email, that's what's going on in email.
Absolutely. And the comparison, I think, is to memos, where we were all trained to write memos that are highly formal, highly stylized, and stilted language, and that sound like everybody else. When you write a memo, your first one that sounds like you, you're kindly boss will take you aside and say, well, it's very good, but this happened to me. My boss said, great memo, cut it down from 7 pages, take out the jokes, and make it sound like everybody else's, and then somebody will read it. The email is exactly the opposite.
Yeah, it's quick. You want to be funny? Maybe tell a little story. There, jokes. Look at the way jokes go around on the internet, on email. So we also see a loosening of control and punctuation and grammar.
That's what some may bemoan.
And this is also something to think about too. It seems to me that it can carry a bit more risk than a paper communication because it can slip out of your hands very easily. It can also be passed around.
Oh, and almost everybody who's been doing email, even for a little while, has a story about hitting the wrong button and sending a reply to everybody instead of to one person. You know, so if it was an email that went to 10 people, you try to do an offline reply, so to speak, to one, and it goes, whoops. Yeah, yes. I mean, that's pretty common. So, yeah, there is risk. But on the other hand, it's in that case, the risk is of people seeing what you actually think. And it's embarrassing, but, you know.
Well, and it also comes across as unedited. A memo, you spend several times editing it, but who sits back other than, I have to admit, I do check my email usually for spelling, but other than that, I don't revise it. I don't try to refine it. You just throw it out, and if you send it out, there is no unsend button.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is the Afternoon Magazine, and we're talking today about the web and how it is changing us. Our guests this afternoon, Peter Kimball. He's with me in the studio. He's a technology trainer at the University of Illinois. On the telephone with us this afternoon, David Weinberger, one of the authors of the Clue Train Manifesto, The End of Business as Usual. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you're welcome to join the conversation this afternoon. Give us a telephone call. Toll free, anywhere you're listening, 1-800-222-9455 in Champaign, Urbana, 333-9455. David, this book is aimed primarily, I think, at businesses, but it would seem to me that there are a lot of lessons here for other folks, lots of things to think about for us who are customers of the web, and maybe even for institutions like higher education and so on and so forth. Have you given this any thought?
Oh, I'm really pleased you said that because in our hearts, the four authors of it, we don't even think of it as a business book. We think of business as the extended example, but that what the web is doing to the hierarchical organization of business and to the loose confederation that is the market, it is absolutely doing everywhere else, from government to education, to the prison system. I made that up. I have nothing to say about the prison system.
I was going to say, wow. What about Peter Kimball? What about the higher education? Do you see possibilities here? Do you?
Well, again, as I'd mentioned earlier, we're very fortunate to being involved in higher education or in education in general because we don't have the tradition is that we'll try to change and not retain our mentality behind walls that we've built. I'd like to look at the subtitle, The End of Business as Usual, for a second, if I may, David. From your perspective, how optimistic are you that in X years, 1, 2, 3, 5 years, majority of businesses will be communicating in a much more human voice?
I am tremendously optimistic. I think there's almost an Hegelian inevitability to this change.
Soon?
This is a generational change, so I'm no good at predicting when certain landmarks will be reached, but it is a generational change.
Yeah, I think in the book, I think if I'm remembering correctly, David Weinberger, you say we're all in there, I'm going to paraphrase here, we're all in there swimming. On the web. But you say we've yet to figure out what the web is really for.
That's right, and that's what makes that remarkable. In other words, I know what a telephone is for, and I know what a highway system is for, you know, for driving on. But that type of answer I haven't heard for the web. I don't know what the web is for in that sense. I don't think anybody does. And what makes that remarkable, I think, is you compare that to the rate of adoption of the web, and it's astounding. Here's a culture that has adopted this technology faster than anything since fire, really. And we can't even say what it's for. So it's touching something deep in us, I believe. I don't know how else to explain the fervor with which we as a culture have greeted this new capability.
Yeah. It puts us back in touch, I think, is part of the answer.
I think that is the big part of the answer. The web is a connective medium. That's why e-commerce is not at the pinnacle of you know, our worldview of the web. E-commerce is one thing you can do, but you can only do it because even that is a form of connection. And thus, since humans and human society is all about connection in one way or another, we are profoundly social. When you introduce a new global form of connection, it's a really important thing.
Let's talk with a listener on line one, a caller in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I have a question for Mr. Weinberger, actually two. One is, would he comment some more, please, about what he said regarding the web changing being a public persona? He didn't elaborate on that, and I'd like to hear more about it. Then the second question would be for either guest. Where is clarity in all of this? Communication depends on clarity to be effective. And in this wide-open format with the loose use of rules of language and whatnot, I wonder if they think clarity will be downgraded and degraded to the point where it suffers.
Okay, I'll try to answer the first question a bit, but it's something I'm still thinking about and starting to write about. So, in other words, I don't know. The question is what effect the web will have on being a public persona or public self. And persona is probably the better word, since it means mask. We're used, this kid who went on into a chat room and sort of casually said to a high school student at Columbine that don't go into school tomorrow because I have to finish what I began. Obviously a reprehensible and totally irresponsible remark, and they shut down the school for 2 days. I heard him on TV, and he said that he is an actor. He's terribly, terribly sorry, but he's an actor, and he was trying out being, I think, John Malkovich. He wanted to see what it felt like to be John Malkovich. Now, I recognize this is pretty wacky. Nevertheless, what I get from this is this is an example of the web as a space in which we play with who we are. In the real world, we're confined by the fact that we live in a particular place. To being a particular self, that is, we build a history, and people expect our self to be consistent throughout that history. They get to know us. On the web, your identity is invented. You can invent, you can think about, because it's a typed medium. I mean, you're using a typewriter, you're writing. You're creating who you are as you type. And you can consciously say, well, now I'd like to be John Malkovich, or see what, you know, not impersonate him, but see what that persona would feel like. People are learning to play with their self on the web, and there is not the persistent history that ties you to a particular self. So it's a very different way of being in public, of being a person, a self in public.
Well, and as far as the clarity, I think the best analogy there might be if you're having a face-to-face conversation with someone, there may not be the best grammar. Of course, spelling doesn't feature in this case. But if something's not clear, you can ask, you can discuss, and the web is so interactive now, even if we just look at the email aspect of the Internet, that as long as it's a two-way communication, if something's not clear, yes, shortcuts have been taken with grammar, with spelling, with structure, but usually with in the worst cases that I've come across, one or two exchanges will clear it up. And I would suspect that anybody who is using it more as a presenting, this is who I am, or this is what our company is, if they're doing it well, if they're being honest about it, then the time will have been taken to not sound stilted, but at least to make sure that the majority of people who look at that can see what you're trying to say. So I don't think the clarity is really that much of a problem. I haven't perceived it to be, although there are certainly some outrageous examples of very cryptic email that I occasionally get.
You want to add anything to that, David?
No, I think that's right.
Yeah. I also think it's interesting that Amazon.com has fairly recently put on a feature on their website. If you go and check out the Clue Train Manifesto and then you read what readers are saying about it, at the bottom of the review it says, "Did you find this review helpful?" So if you're not going to be clear, I don't think you're going to be heard.
Well, and it even goes further than that. It says 42 out of 57 reviewers found, or 47 out of 52
right.
people found this to be a useful review, so we're now reviewing the reviewers.
But this is, I think, a great example of the web inventing new forms of conversation, just as we go. And that's why, by the way, predictions about where we'll be in 5 years are, I think, almost always going to be wrongheaded. This is a new type of conversation. And posting a review is an old type of conversation. We haven't been able to do it the way we can on the web, for example, at Amazon. But it turns out that you know, you get 1,000 kids reviewing Harry Potter, and it sort of, you know, nobody reads to the bottom. So we, as a culture, are inventing new ways of talking. And one of them is this evaluate, this did you find this review helpful? Another is that at Amazon you can click on the reviewer and see other reviews that she or he has written, which is a way of getting some context for that reviewer.
Do you know, does Amazon.com clean up spelling grammar?
No.
No, okay. I haven't
not of its books and not of its reviews.
I will check out Harry Potter now and see what kids are saying. That sounds like a fun thing to do. We're coming down here in the last few minutes. Back to this idea of, you know, we're all out there doing this, or a good number of us are, but yeah, we're still trying to figure out what it's all about. But in the book, you do offer some themes as to the character of the web, David. Maybe you'd talk with us about a couple of those.
Well, for example, let me know if this is what you're referring to. The web is, in terms of its sort of technical architecture, is decentralized. There is no center to it. Nobody owns it.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody built it. Nobody maintains it. And because of that, it's everybody has to maintain it themselves. So there's no helpline to go to, nobody else to blame. One of the things that Tim Berners-Lee, who invented the web, has said is that the web is always going to be a little bit broken. Well, that's a consequence of it not being centralized. It's also a consequence of its size. But because it's always going to be broken, and because there's nobody to fix it, you can't. There's no complaint desk. You learn that, or you actually remember what you always already knew, which is everything that humans build is a little bit broken, including, and this maybe especially, complex organizations like corporations and businesses and schools and governments. So instead of having to maintain a facade of zero tolerance for human imperfection, you can loosen up a little bit. You can tolerate the bad spelling because somebody's saying something interest that really matters to her heart. That type of acceptance of human fallibility, I think, is personally, I think it's wonderful. And second of all, it changes. Once it penetrates into the corporation, it changes much of the superficial controlling aspects of the company. They can loosen up. They can get a sense of humor. They can laugh at themselves a bit. Mm. Not a bad thing.
Yeah. We've got another caller coming in, and I'm going to go to that caller as soon as we've got them ready to go on the air. And here we go, our next caller on line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to pick up on that point of the web being decentralized. And how do you reconcile that with the fact that the backbone providers are just a few of them, UUNet and a few others? And without knowing too much about the structure of the backbone, it seems like these four or five companies do have an awful lot of quote-unquote centralized power.
And somebody in some coverage from Virginia today about the primary there, a Virginia state representative bragged that 50% of internet communications goes through the state of Virginia. But that's an important point. It's at the level of the wires. And the web, there are lots of ways of viewing the web. It's also decentralized. It is decentralized, and I think more importantly, at the level of the routers that are moving the messages around, and most importantly, at the level of human contact with it. There is no center the way that there is in a corporation where there's at least a top, And in that sense, the decentralization, whether what's happening in the wires underneath, in a sense, doesn't matter to the people who are on the web.
Right. What about the what is your opinion of the overall process of privatization that we went through around 1995, and how the NSF, National Science Foundation, how they handled all that? Do you think that there was a genuine attempt made to keep enough competition in there for the backbone?
I have no idea. Human fallibility. There's many more things I don't know than I do, and I've got nothing sensible to say.
I'd like to toss in one thing as far as the decentralization. This kind of came out with the denial of service attacks that shut down many of the websites, and the question was, well, can't the government step in and do something? And it would be difficult, and the concern on some parts was that, well, no, we don't really want the some kind of infrastructure that's going to be monitoring all this traffic and discerning patterns of attacks, although we do want to prevent those kinds of things from shutting down. I think the saving grace here is that the amount of traffic and the amount of use of the web and the Internet is going to increase at a rate far faster than any of the large telecommunication companies could, or the government could institute some sort of monitoring so we know to whom you spoke and when you spoke.
So I guess even if there is some concentration today, there will not be in the future, is that?
Or the sheer volume of material that's being passed through. Yes, there may be 5 or 10 different fiber lines that connect 90% of all traffic between Chicago and Denver, but the sheer volume of traffic is going to prevent abuse of privacy in that way, I think.
You know, I'm sure you're familiar with the, controversy over the domain name registration.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and so you know that with the establishment of ICANN that there's at least something like an attempt to decentralize who owns the process of giving out the .com names and the .org names.
Right.
Whether that's the right attempt or not is a difficult question, but it's I believe it's the right thing to try to do.
Well, absolutely, without a doubt. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call this afternoon. We just have a couple of minutes left to spend together today on this topic. Before we go, I did want to ask you, David Weinberger, about something that I think is very important in your book. This is the importance of genuineness, the importance of trust on the web. Even though nobody on the Internet may know you're a dog, you got to be real somehow, right?
Yes, because you'll be found out otherwise. First of all, if you're a person and you want to take advantage of the web, enjoy it, then you want to be yourself. That's much of the joy of the web, is the ability to express yourself in your own voice, even with the spelling mistakes, if that's, you know, that's what's required. If you're a business, it's much harder, because businesses are not, first of all, they're not people. So in what sense are they authentic or not? In what sense are they a self or not? But they're structured not to be, in any sense, authentic. They're structured to try to sell you stuff. That's what they're geared towards. So it makes it's a much bigger challenge for a company to figure out how to be on the web and to be genuine. One of the things that human beings look for when we try to decide whether the person that whose messages we're reading is, you know, full of baloney or actually being authentic, we look for some distance from yourself, a sense of humor maybe. It's one of the ways of manifesting that. For some informality, for the ability to respond, to express emotion, positive and negative, to admit ignorance. I mean, maybe that's a formula for how to deceive people into thinking that you're authentic. But generally, I'm optimistic about our ability to discern who's speaking and who's just reading from the script.
Peter, any last thoughts?
One area I wish we'd been able to explore a little bit is the blurring of the distinctions between personal time and work time. But that's a reason for people to pick up this book, I suspect.
Yeah, maybe we can get together at another point down the line and talk about some of the other issues that are raised. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Really interesting.
David Weinberger has been our guest this afternoon, one of the authors of the Clue Train Manifesto, The End of Business as Usual. Also with us this afternoon, University of Illinois technology trainer Peter Kimball.